My name is Sharon Anderson, and I'm here in the village. In another life, I direct a leadership center at the Humphrey Institute, which is part, it's actually a school of public affairs within the University of Minnesota. So I work with a lot of people like yourselves who are working to address leadership issues. Most of my work, I'm not a theorist, I'm not a researcher, I'm a facilitator. So, and I have a chance to work with a lot of interesting people and projects. The center that I direct also hosts all the international fellows and scholars in the Humphrey Institute. So my colleagues in the center are people from all over the world. So we have lots of interesting discussions about leadership in across cultures and what that means. But what I'd like to do tonight, if you're willing to help me out, is I'd like to talk a little bit about, for you and the work that you do, when you think about your work, what are some leadership challenges that you're either thinking about or challenged by, either leadership challenges in general in the communities that you're working in or the organizations you're part of in your families, or things that you would consider to be sort of ethical dilemmas for yourself. And I would define an ethical dilemma not sort of questions of right and wrong, but even questions of when two rights collide. So that struggles that you have in your life where you want to spend time with your family and at the same time you want to spend time in, say, an organization you're part of. So I'd like to just open it up and hear a little, and then I'd like to take some notes. And maybe at the end of the hour we can say, are there some themes that seem to be percolating that we might have in common that we could spend some more time, or it would help me in terms of developing maybe a session for next week or later in the week, that sort of thing. So, and we can all sort of chime in. Maybe we can think of ways, too, that we might even be able to help each other think more about some of the situations that we're working in. So with that, I'd like, Melvin and I started out. I'll tell you about a little challenge that I have. I was invited in the city of Minneapolis. We have a lot of different neighborhoods that we have $5 million a year that the city set aside to help neighborhoods in their leadership work. And the city of Minneapolis has divided itself somewhat arbitrarily into about 80 neighborhoods. And I've been invited to partner with neighborhoods throughout the city to develop a leadership program, some leadership resources for people and projects in the city of Minneapolis. And some of the things is I've had a chance and lots of conversations with a lot of neighborhoods over the last 6 or 7 months is that one of the challenges I'm seeing is that we have a lot of really good ideas of the city, but we don't really have kind of together a sense of what we're trying to create. And because of that, we sometimes it seems as though we have conflicts. So should we strengthen our parks or should we create more childcare for kids in a neighborhood? And so sometimes people start arguing about those things where we're trying to figure out better ways to kind of weave a variety of challenges together. So it's this notion of how do we sort of together build a shared focus and not sort of having to vote where I say I have an idea and you might have an idea, where we have winners and losers, but finding more effective ways to sort of weave together the agenda of a city and then work together on solving that. So that's something that I'm going to spend a lot of time thinking about over the next few months and trying to figure out how we can help ourselves do that. So what about some of the rest of you?
I'm a Judith Vittori exec, and I work with about 60 congregations. And I think we've got a leadership crisis in the church because of the need to change. And our pastors are not, most pastors are not leaders, they're pastors. And by that I mean they do not know how to develop vision and do not know how to lead an organization toward change and even to look at what changes need to take place to make this an effective entity within a community. George Barna, who's done a lot of work with congregations and studying congregations, maybe read some of his stuff, said that there's basically at best 5% of pastors have a vision for their church in this country. And so there is a tremendous leadership crisis, I think, within the church, and that's one of the reasons we move so slowly. So the question there then is how can we help congregations make the changes necessary just to survive?
Mm-hmm.
Because what they're saying now is congregations that have 50 or less on Sunday morning, which is a whole lot, within the next 8 years, 80% of these will go out of existence. A lot of it's because they're mostly older people. People die away. And, you know, they can't attract families because they don't offer anything. You know, they just can't offer programming for families. So there's a lot of stuff there that I'm real concerned about. And so how do we help congregations to develop leadership? And how do we find people to... Can lay people be empowered within congregations, which a lot of pastors don't really allow? Can they be empowered to use their gifts of leadership in the absence of leadership from pastors? So I guess that's some of the stuff I really struggle with.
So really raising questions, and is there a difference? It sounds almost like a difference between leadership and leaders.
Providing leadership, that is developing and casting vision, for example, I think is absolutely crucial. And there's almost a total lack of that in the church. The lay people, there are some of them doing that work, but it's hard if you're quote, leader, your pastor mm-hmm. isn't able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And the pastor is positional leader.
Yeah.
That people have. And maybe we've created our church so that we think that we consume the positional leader's vision or whatever, that we're consumers more than creators. So maybe it raises the question of how then positional leaders can be more of a facilitator. Because I basically think maybe in some ways we have to sort of co-create our vision. So that they're more meaningful. Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that while one reason for this dilemma is that the congregations do not call people because of their leadership gifts, but isn't there another possibility, and that is that generally the church is not clear as to its mission, and when the church is not clear as to its mission, how can it expect the leadership to have the vision?
Mm-hmm. Unless people never want change, too. You know, they want to adhere to the older ways that we did things. And
so the good old days.
And you have to change.
Does everybody believe that? I mean, is there some consensus around whether or not we should be changing and for what? But I mean, I think that a lot of us wrestle with that sort of vision question. There's a lot of people talking, though, about sort of then co-creating some kind of shared sense of direction and vision and figuring out ways that we can do that together. And it's really pretty hard to get people engaged if we're not clear on what we're trying to build. Then it's really hard to sort of get people really actively working toward that. And particularly if the church for some has become sort of a provider or service where you come to consume rather than where you go to work to build, which is a different focus. You know, and I mean in the United States, a lot of us, I think, our sort of mainstream culture is a consumer culture, right? And so the church maybe has become part of that. So it raises, those are hard questions. We have to talk more, you know, work more beyond that. But I think that more and more a lot of us have to think of ourselves more as facilitators to then engage a lot of people to kind of, it's that notion that you're the leaders you've been waiting for, mm-hmm. as opposed to hoping that somebody will walk through the door to save us from ourselves. I mean, from those of you who I've talked with that have been here in the village, I mean, I think that's one of the success stories about a place like the village is that it's a place where people come to work and to talk and to work together, where you create community.
think there's still challenges there too when you've got people coming in for short periods of time. How do you include their gifts that they bring in? At first, you know, help them to identify their gifts they bring into community and be able to share those gifts so that those that have been here a while won't say, well, we've always done it this way. You know, at Holden, that's like 2 weeks and it's become, that's how we've always done it. But, you know, how do you include new people and identify their gifts and get them in and feeling a part of the vision? I mean, we have a mission statement, but how do, you know, as they come, I think that's what our Deep River thing is supposed to be about, too, our program we have for short-term and long-term staff, is to help you identify your intent in coming to the community and the gifts that you bring, and then how to get that in into the mission of the place. And you know, we fail miserably often, and we succeed sometimes, but because of the transientness, which in some ways is not, it's just an accelerated parish. I mean, parishes have turnover like crazy as well, and most organizations seem to in our culture, but here, you've got people for 3 weeks, you've got people for 6 weeks, you've got people for a year, you've got some people here for 5 years, for 3 years. How do the five-year people not feel that they are the only ones that hold the vision since they're here the longest? So that struggle, mm-hmm. I think, is very, very much alive in the village.
So it's that dependency issue on sort of somebody out there setting the agenda, and then we react to that rather than feeling we have an agenda.
Or the leadership feeling that they've got to hold it together because everybody else is going to go down the road. Mm-hmm. And so then they can get isolated in their sense of responsibility to hold the vision and then not include other people because of that, you know, these people are all going to leave. So there's struggles from both sides, both those that are in positional leadership and those that come in ready to offer their gifts.
For some of you who think of a project or something you've been a part of where you think that there was a real clear focus, I mean, like everybody was working the same agenda, what was going on? I mean, how did that come about? Can you think of something where... And don't limit yourself to within the institutionalized church.
Yeah, like a fundraiser for a theater. Everybody knows what you're trying to do. You've got a very clear goal. And it's easier to get volunteers in that case, you know, if you train them. And mm-hmm. if it's short term, it's specific. Everybody knows what you're trying to achieve.
So you can describe it, you can quantify it. Mm-hmm. It's real tangible.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you can visualize it in your mind. You can see a picture of it.
Mm-hmm. You break it down into little pieces. You can hand out little pieces of it to people. You know, there's not many projects.
It's something that can get people energized. Like, I'm for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts that people have of kind of where you think the vision, the focus is really clear. What were components of that? I mean,
our hospital is a little rural hospital, and we just had a group. We've been struggling. Had a group that had a strategic plan. They've been working on what the hospital's going to go, what they plan for the future, and that. And when it's all written down with their mission statement, and everything, it really looks like, hey, we can do this. But how do you, you know? To some, that looks real black and white. This is what we're going to do. People are all fired up about it, but getting the participation from everybody in the organization, it seems like that is going to have to happen, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
So in that situation, you feel like you're clear on the focus.
Focus.
But you're a little bit uncertain as to whether or not everybody's going to get engaged with that.
The leadership can, you know, because it would be, I think there's still that people thinking that the leadership is going to fix it. Mm-hmm. They've done this, so they're going to fix it, and we don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. To me, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it on paper is a good focus, but how do you get beyond that?
In the real world, is it going to really motivate and engage people?
Somehow, generally, it taps into the needs or interests of those you want to involve, that they see that they either can contribute or that it will accomplish something that they want in some way, even a little piece of it. I guess the other thing I see is at the core, there's always people with a passion for that, that are willing to, we always say, are you willing to die for it? I mean, not that you have to die for it, but they just feel so passionate about it that they're willing to sacrifice almost anything for it. And people follow others with a passion, even if they're crazy. I mean, we know that from our society. So, you know, I think that's a good way to get a project really moving is to have some people with a passion for it at the center.
That's another way to kind of get people engaged is to excite them about something. It's that question I think about, is this important deal? I mean, like, really important. Is it meaningful? And I think that's another way that, in terms of a vision, we've got to ask everybody to say, is this important to us?
More so than just jobs.
And not just having somebody come and say, well, here's our mission. No, but to have a dialogue and really, let's talk about that. If we were to focus on this, yeah, is this, how can we make this important to all of us?
You can go the other way around there too. Not that somebody sees some use or need fulfilled to himself, but who's involved, and other people will support that person. That's where the passionate people come in. Who's in there? Yeah, I support that person. That's very important who's on in there, because community things, we have small community, small town, there are always conflicting interests, and the meeting is too short, so everybody argues his own idea. But if there's somebody passionate about it, and then, yeah, what does he do otherwise? And community will support that person.
I think that's a good point, too. Increasingly, we're all working in places and with people that we may not like everybody, we may not be familiar with everybody, but it's about community life and public life, where increasingly it's more diverse. And figuring out ways that we can sit side by side and work on something together to sort of make it better for the greater good, as opposed to, I think we've all been in situations where, you know, we've, when you work with everybody, other people that are more familiar, to a certain extent, it's a little bit easier, can be easier.
Yeah. You may say it's nothing in it for me, but if I can't make that person happy, that's good enough.
And we're working on a lot of projects where we're looking at in public life. For example, in public education, I would consider education to be a public good, and that it's in everybody's best interest that we have a quality system, even though we come to the table with very different answers to what's important here, of really needing to weave together a lot of different ideas. I think it's, I'm increasingly challenged in situations where to sort of vote and build consensus by voting doesn't work very well, and that we have winners and losers, but needing to have much more discussion.
How much do you feel time is wasted building consensus all the time? I get that sometimes. It takes forever.
And that's a cultural thing. I mean, in the United States particularly, efficiency is, there's a high value placed on efficiency. And if you think that the mission is at the end of the rainbow rather than in the journey, you see, and we need to talk about that as well, because then we sort of have different answers to kind of what's important. And sometimes we lose people when, if my value is that we do this efficiently and quickly, then sometimes we miss people because they say, I don't belong here. They don't understand. They don't get it. And so I think all of those things become important in leadership work. I mean, it's not either or. I'm increasingly believing that it's all of the above. And so I think a lot of these situations call for leadership and a real diversity of leaders and contributions and gifts, rather than sort of the heroic notion that if we just had a leader like a pastor, that we have to begin to assume more and more responsibility collectively to kind of figure out sort of an approach to these things.
So maybe an example, if let's say you're running a board that has 12 people on it, that some people dominate, some people rarely say anything, other people have very good contributions, but you don't hear much from them, and you're approaching an important decision. How do you approach discussion on that, or how do you encourage discussion on that, so that you get, you feel like everybody got their two cents worth in, so they won't try to undermine it later if they felt like the decision was wrong. Yeah, they get, you get an, or you change the decision. I mean, obviously you can influence it.
Well, I can give you, and we can, let's open it up. I can give you an example. And there was a study that was recently done where people who sit on boards of directors were surveyed, quite a few of them, and asked, only 7% of people in the United States who serve on nonprofit boards of directors feel that their capacities, their gifts, are well utilized. Okay, 7%. Okay, so I think, you know, before we sort of start training people more, we have to look at ways we can embrace what we already know how to do. So I think that's a challenge to say, try something out. I mean, we can't go much more wrong than we already are. Yeah. And so I started thinking about that, and I'm currently chairing the board of a, or I was asked to chair the board of a community-based organization that does community development work in the state of Minnesota in neighborhoods. It's very much on a capacity. It's, we do little projects, not big projects. And so I agreed to do that if, I agreed to chair the board if we could try it a new way. And I began to see where a lot of community-based organizations I was a part of, they were almost interchangeable, our meetings were. We do minutes and we do, I mean, there's kind of a structured thing. And I thought it was sort of boring. And we'd sort of just go, we weren't really engaged, at least I felt I wasn't. So, and I started talking with other people and they were sort of in agreement, but it was kind of the culture. And so we invented a new way. And in this situation, what we invented together was we agreed to sort of do, you know, there are requirements for community-based organizations, like you have to do certain things by law in order to maintain your nonprofit status. So we agreed to do some of our work behind the scenes. So our treasurer was willing to be available to any of us if we had questions on the financials. And so we had a way of doing a lot of our homework as individual board members beforehand. We took the first 10 meeting minutes of our meeting then to do sort of boilerplate organizational work that we needed to for sort of the organization's history. And then we decide the rest of our meetings, we have an ongoing dialogue. We usually have a meal together. And we invite in other people that are interested in that topic. So we don't just include ourselves. We might invite in neighborhood people in neighborhoods that we're working in. We might invite in other people who sort of have done some of the kind of work that we're thinking about getting into. We might invite in people from funding organizations or foundations to visit with us. But we have, and we sort of create it as we go. So this particular organization, we're doing some work in some poor neighborhoods in the city of St. Paul with children. And so we've invited in kids. We have long discussions about children and our own personal histories of kind of as children, or talking about projects we've been a part of, work that we've been a part of. And so we have an ongoing dialogue, and themes come up during our conversations where we'll sort of roll it over. But, and then we occasionally take time out to say, what do our stories tell us about how we might do work as an organization? And I find it very renewing, personally. I mean, I just love to go to meetings. I feel like I've gotten to know a lot of my colleagues and people that work with the organization and are trying to co-create and build communities. And so we're not sort of the providers and the consumers, you know, which a lot of organizations, you're either a provider and you offer a professional service, or it's more of that model of community. We're sort of, we sort of give and take to each other so that we help each other out. We often talk about what things that we personally as individuals are working on and want to get out of it. So that's an example with a board where I think we just need to free ourselves to try out some new things. What about some of the rest of you in terms of meetings where you feel like you're trying to be more effective with the group that you're working with? Some of you tried some other models of sort of...
Well, when I was in Parrish, we had a fairly large staff. I would spend the first quarter of every staff meeting at least in relational kinds of things. It might be doing affirmations or... and then we did at least one retreat a year in which we told our stories, basically. And we'd spend the whole retreat doing nothing but telling our own stories. And each person might have an hour. And I usually gave them a kind of a format that they could use that was easy to use. But I found by building relationships in our meetings, the business part of the meeting, what we had to get done, went quicker because we were more on the same wavelength, more listening to each other. And it was a lot more interesting to be at the meetings. I think people don't get fed. They come to meetings generally and they get taken away from, their energy is depleted. And that's why we don't want to go to meetings. And if somehow we can be energized while we're at a meeting as well as giving, I think that's what makes meetings exciting. So I don't like to go to meetings if I can get out of them, unless there's a relational component in them. So I think that's what's critical. And the journey is the destination. So what we accomplish there isn't always that important, no matter how important it is. The relationship is more important than the product.
So even thinking in your mind, the metaphor is to sort of build community rather than to have a meeting.
Exactly.
So thinking differently about, you know, what would it happen when you're driving to your board meeting if you're thinking, you know, this is a session where we need to work to build our community rather than have a meeting. I mean, maybe even the pictures in our mind that we think about. But I think a lot of us get intimidated in meeting environments too. You know, where you might not feel as though your perspective or you don't have permission to speak up. So I think, you know, good idea. And I think there are lots of ways that, and what are things that you'd like to see happen in those environments that you think might make it better?
Well, we've tried different things with different groups, you know, even kind of taking a poll, you know, as you're discussing an issue, and so you sort of force people to to at least make a statement as to where they stand, you know, things of that nature. And you know, part of it is, you know, these are nonprofit groups. Everybody's a volunteer that's there, and you know, you miss meetings on occasion, and people don't always feel like they're up to speed on every issue, and that's where you can get easily intimidated, because it's not your vocation or your profession, so you're doing what you can, but you can only do so much, and so it's difficult. And church boards, the same type of problem. I think I agree there's a real leadership crisis in the church, and the issue really does come down to who's leading the church. Is it the pastor? Is it the lay leadership? If so, who is it? Is it going to be consistent? Is there follow through? Is it just somebody's 1-year vision? Is there president of the congregation or something of that nature? Or, you know, how do you make it consistent follow through? I think that's where a lot of churches are having a lot of problems.
How do you distinguish between leader and facilitator?
How would you distinguish? Is there a clear distinction for you?
Well, I really hadn't thought about it until I came in and you said you were not a leader, you were a facilitator. I don't think I have a good answer.
I think it's the new lexicon is getting used. You're not much different. A good leader uses, facilitates his people.
Different leadership is called for in different situations, I think. So that I think sometimes you're called to take charge, that the situation calls for that. So leadership can involve a variety of roles and functions, I think. I think more and more in the United States, but also in sort of world development and development issues that I'm a part of, there have been models of expertise. So the leader has come in as the expert. More and more has been written and being discussed now in terms of the role and the function of a leader may be more effective in many settings where they need to be more of a facilitator and a community builder to empower the community to do its own work rather than coming in as an expert. Now, part of that is that I think to a certain extent we get messages whether or not we're an expert or not. And so some people don't come to the table because they don't feel like they're the expert. They're waiting, they're on the reactive side. So I think, you know, there's small distinctions.
Be also a cultural thing, how leadership is perceived, like in our democratic group settings and so on, the facilitator is there. Mm-hmm. And a leader, if you have another hierarchical structured culture, you're the leader. And, but they do, from my thinking, the same thing, bring out the facilities they have in the community and the people. And the facilitator is a democratic process used more than in other cultures. Mm-hmm. In other cultures, you have the guy, that's the guy in charge.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be my distinction, that if we really are believe in democratic, being democratic, mm-hmm. then we want to be facilitators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had a comment.
Well, I had a comment, and I'm wondering how much ownership you take on Nader's comment there, that statement?
I just put it there to get us thinking.
I have a problem with that, frankly. I've served in several capacities, quote, leadership, assumed leadership capacities, or given leadership capacities, and I would really go the opposite way with that statement and say something to the effect that the function of leadership is to help people understand their role as followers. I don't think corporate America would survive today with that, if that mm-hmm. were fulfilled, mm-hmm. frankly. I don't think the church would function if that were fulfilled.
So it's a greater good. And
I really think that the good leader is the one who can help his people understand that following is noble, mm-hmm. that following, that contributing, mm-hmm. that participating in the greater good is mm-hmm. A noble mm-hmm. role to play. And that we are not all leaders. And that has to do with consensus building on issues, but it hasn't really to do with leadership. It has to do with helping people understand how we get the job done, and not all can be leaders.
And that notion of servanthood.
Yeah, really. And, well, the leader is perhaps the primeval servant who models what it means to lead. And I don't mean just from a church point of view, but I think the most effective corporate CEOs are the ones who model what it means to serve, and that is to mm-hmm. listen to the interests mm-hmm. and not just work from the top down.
Mm-hmm. Probably a good example then is the hospital that you were talking about. You know, everybody put together the vision, and now you need some workers, you need some followers to put an action plan into place, and everybody's got to take ownership in their part, realizing that it's contributing to the total vision. It takes a leader to kind of facilitate that happening and to assign the responsibilities. But if everybody wants to be a leader again, they're going to try to reinvent the vision, which isn't what should be done. But that's the trap you get into many times. Everybody's got to go and do their part of it to get to actually accomplish the vision.
And that's very much a part of, some people are working really hard to get better clarity on this notion of what some call shared power, which is when do you take charge and when do you empower others and sort of nurture that sort of community action. Some find leadership, even the word leadership, very distracting. I just spent the last 3 days in a graduate seminar with people from all over the world. And I was looking at cross-cultural leadership, some of the things that you mentioned. But different cultures have very different ways and want to deal differently with sort of the role of the leader as sort of taking charge, not this participatory thing. You know, it's kind of like that depending upon the context from where we're working, that to use the gifts of the people in the room, it demands that we sort of understand the cultural context that people are coming out of. Part of my work is working with international fellows and scholars in the university. And we have long discussions because for some people it's very difficult when they come to the United States to get into this sort of a chatty, collaborative style. As they're very used to kind of having somebody come in and teach a class and sort of put the answers out there, put the information out there, not having a discussion. And so part of that is the style, I think, has to be aligned with what we're trying to accomplish. But then a discussion, too, of sort of what we're all accustomed to. There's a lot of people, some of you have done work on around gender. And so the style or the culture of women sometimes is different than, say, a corporate setting, where there's a different kind of history in terms of the way work gets done and style. So I think all of those things are important, but sometimes, like in a congregation, people come to the table with very different experiences. And I think sometimes we can be more effective when we sort of embrace those and then talk more about how things get done. I'm currently working with some educators where we're trying to involve more people of color in administrative positions. And that's something that comes up often in our conversations, is that the question of whether or not my job is to learn your system or we're to co-create a system that seems to be able to better utilize all of our gifts. And so part of that we're getting at through conversation, where one person couldn't just take charge, but we all have to sort of work on it together and co-create it. So that would be a situation where I think it calls for some facilitation to try to get a lot of different ideas and weave them and try to make some sense of that to how we structure our work then. But there are many situations where we sort of know what the issue is and we need to take charge.
Well, I also think, whether we admit it or not, that money has a lot to do with how leadership is followed, how leadership is heard, and that if you pay someone enough, they will follow. They will not aspire to leadership. If you ask them to do a job and you pay them enough, they will do it. And they won't ask any questions. You can't do that in the culture we call the church. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a foreign idea to be paid for a service that maybe in your conscience you say should be done out of total servanthood as a mm-hmm. child of God or something. That same person in a corporate context would say, you know, what am I worth? Mm-hmm. I'll do it if I'm paid enough. And I think there's a real problem here in the transition and interface between the Christian culture and the institutional setting of the church mm-hmm. and that person's mm-hmm. potential leadership ability in the corporate world, if he or she works in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. And there are some who would say it's not even the corporate world, that the market metaphor, the way
business,
markets work,
the
is sort of a pattern that's getting established in a lot of the minds of the people in the world.
It's a very cultural thing too, this money thing. That is where culture has established means to measure things in money. There are other cultures where money, you can't make anybody do anything for any money if his status is affected in the community. There are trade-offs that our society can move a lot of things by money. Others can't. You have to employ other motivational factors.
Mm-hmm. And maybe some of that is personal work that each of us needs to do in terms of what becomes our driver.
Mm-hmm. I like Warren Bennis did in leadership, his empowerment model, competency, community, mm-hmm. significance, and joy. Mm-hmm. I think that works whether it's the church or business. I mean, mm-hmm. he applies it to business, but I think that's a tremendous empowerment model for within the church. It mm-hmm. works either place, because if people feel competent and you give them the training they need to do the job, if they have community, a sense of community, connectedness in some way, mm-hmm. if they see how what they do fits in, the significance of what they're doing, and if they enjoy it, that is usually if it fits with their gifts, mm-hmm. they're empowered. It can be business or otherwise. I mean, and I think that's a wonderful model for the church.
I think, and let me get back to your comment. There are others who would say, like Parker Palmer, that we can't be outwardly driven, that we have to be inwardly driven. And so part of this money thing is a challenge for each of us to go within, to take a really hard look at our internal drivers. And that kind of rigor is necessary as well. So I think that's true, that we need to kind of look at sort of the external frameworks that might help us in doing some of this work. But also to start asking ourselves individually. And I do that. I struggle with that all the time. What's really important here? You know, how I use my time, how I set my priorities, what are my drivers? Rather than sort of being seduced by the external world and having outside things tell me what's important. But I think a lot, you know, all of us are looking for communities and environments where we sort of have some rigor in both of those. You're going to make a comment.
Well, my comment was, I think, saying a little differently what you said. I mean, whether you call it dollars or whether you call it, you know, your own internal driver, it's the same thing. I mean, some things you're willing to set up a money amount for, but the studies I've seen have shown that there are other drivers that are more powerful than money. And for, you know, the general, why are you involved in this? And I think you spoke to that well in terms of the feelings of satisfaction, the feelings of doing a job that needs to be done so you get, and knowing that you can do it well, and that you feel affirmed because you know you've done it well. So it, you know, whether it's, you know, I don't think the money driver I think there's a lot of people that think that'll work, but in the long term for commitment, I know for myself that it doesn't work. It's not a driver that will keep me in the task.
It also has to do with what level you're living at. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you're really scratched for money, money is a bigger driver mm-hmm. than other things. If you don't mm-hmm. scratch for money, other things can mm-hmm. want to play.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. I was reminded of that recently with a colleague from Ethiopia. And some of you have worked with kind of leadership assessment instruments. Have any of you taken the Myers-Briggs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But tools like that are often used in organizations or groups in the United States. And Hopte said to me, he says, you know, I'm worried about the kids starving in Ethiopia. You know, to him, those assessment instruments were sort of navel-gazing. It's kind of like, you know, who cares? So again, that context and the perspective are really important about what's really important. I think another thing for me is that leadership isn't always about success. That, you know, when you think about it, leadership sometimes is about getting killed, literally. And so when we start looking at what's really important, then it raises really hard questions about what are we really willing to sort of stand up for. And trying to create environments where we can really get into that. So I would distinguish some things about sort of organizing projects and then looking sort of at those deeper meanings so that we
don't have the intergenerational conversation like we have at Holy in most of our, in many of our churches.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, I see pastors, many of them, struggling with this question and not knowing how to give leadership or what to do about it.
Well, mm-hmm.
Is this something you've dealt with?
Well, one of the things that some of the people that I'm working with are finding really helpful, and some of you are familiar with the Search Institute because you're good Lutherans, and but it's built on some of the frameworks now on capacity building. But it gets away from an expert model. It gets away from sort of leader and the leadership. And it begins to look at then not what you want to fix. I'm a big believer that I think a lot of work we get into kind of focusing on what's the problem of the day. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced that sometimes it's different to look at what we want to build for ourselves. then what are the problems we need to fix? And that our spirits get bedraggled sometimes when we're always sort of looking at what we need to fix as opposed to trying to get more energized by thinking about what we want to build and create. So I'm interested in looking at the difference in a lot of strategic planning in the United States, but also in development work, is framed on a fix-it model. So if you look at the notion of strategic planning, it's built on what you want to fix, and it's on problem solving. And on the capacity building model, it's focused on what you want to build. And so I don't know if any of you have worked with John McKnight of Northwestern, who's done a lot of community development work.
And Jody Kretzman was here a couple weeks
ago. Okay. And they work together. Mm-hmm. But the building model, and when you fix it, what you do is you do a needs assessment. Mm-hmm. Okay? Some of the work where we're focusing on building, what we're doing is we're doing capacity audits of whole regional, like in some rural regions in Ohio, where we've actually gone and gotten everybody to say, what can you do? I mean, if we know we want to build a house, the next thing we do is we do a capacity audit to say, well, what can you do? Are you a plumber? Can you build cabinets? I mean, what can people actually do? So you weave together people's capacity. As opposed to doing a needs assessment, which is to say, what are the problems? Okay. Then, in this model, then after you do a capacity assessment, then you begin to say, well, if these are capacity, and if we don't have somebody that can do build cabinets, then we need to network and build a partnership because we still need a plumber or a cabinet maker. So that it clarifies then when you start thinking, who should we partner with? It's pretty clear that if this is what we're trying to build, then we know what we can do for ourselves and where we need to build some partnerships. So it's a different model, but based on a capacity model. And I think some of that's really quite helpful.
I think he brings up a perfect example of our church. I think churches sense they've got to do something. And the contemporary or traditional service is the quick fix. Mm-hmm. It's the magic pill that's going to solve it for a lot of our churches. And what I see is it's a climate and culture issue. It's not let's get a quick fix. That really they got to go back to ground zero. And mm-hmm. you're talking about building. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, what are we trying to do here? What kind of climate do we need to create? And maybe a contemporary service will help that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe some other kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. But that's down the line. Mm-hmm. You really got to go back a step rather than quick, just add on this thing to quick fix it or magic pill. Mm-hmm. You know, which is really what's happening. And then you cram that down people's throat and they're not happy. And the climate is not good, so it doesn't really accomplish what they hope
it
will.
Makes things worse rather than
so
better.
I've seen more contemporary services go down the tubes because there was no climate to support it. There's no reason for it other than let's do something modern or different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We want church renewal without asking the question, what is the church and what is our purpose as a church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which gets back to the earlier point of the need to have focus and agree upon a focus so that we're not dependent on somebody to tell us, well, what is it we're trying to do here? Now, I did a project for Alcoa a while back where rather than having a mission statement, they brought in some artists and they co-created. They have a huge mural. And that picture, anybody in that organization can tell you the story of that mural. And it has the history of the organization. It has what they're working on, and anybody that you talk to can tell you, here's what we're trying to build here, and here's my job, and here's what I'm doing to help bring that about. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of us are in organizations and settings where we don't have a clue about what we're trying to build, so no wonder we don't know how to offer our gifts. See, and then we become dependent on somebody to tell us, rather than figuring out a better way to sort of co-create it together and shared responsibility. Phil McKnight is looking at, they're looking at a lot of things there, of shared responsibility rather than sort of experts and consumers. And I think a lot of us are in environments where I'm just a consumer here. And then we get into being reactive rather than proactive. But if we don't know what we're trying to build, it's pretty hard to be proactive about building it. And so those are all sort of complex things. But I think you're right that a lot of us are also trying to work to create an environment where we sort of work differently together. And I just think that every situation is different. You know, people have different cultural expectations. So unfortunately, there aren't easy cookie-cutter answers to these leadership challenges. I think you're right. A lot of us are in the context where money does sort of drive a lot of things, whether we're aware of it or not. And that a lot of us get messages that, you know, who you are. I mean, I think even I'm in a lot of settings where we do leadership programs for positional leaders, or even for kids in organizations, colleges and high schools, where you have leadership programs for student leaders. That means those are the kids that are heads of student organizations. But we don't have followership programs for all the rest of the kids. When we start talking to kids, it gives them real clear messages about their gifts and how they might contribute in their school. And so I think there are sort of lots of challenges and lots of confusion about leaders and followers. And I think we need to kind of constantly be asking ourselves and having discussions about that. I've been in a lot of organizations where people don't even allow them to think of themselves as being able to provide leadership and having gifts that they can provide. I did a program in Minnesota with older women. And when you're trying to figure out what happens to leadership and the leaders to better understand the leadership of older women. And when we first started working on that project, we'd ask women if they saw themselves as leaders. And unless they had been involved as positional leaders like in corporations, no, they were involved in getting things done. I mean, it wasn't even an interesting question to them. But they were involved in all sorts of projects in the community and their churches and organizations where they made a difference. And they brought their gifts to the table. So I think even the word leadership can be really not very helpful sometimes. And unfortunately, you know, it's the sort of thing where people feel like they aren't invited and not included.
Have you done any studies, or are you aware of any situations where the church, either regionally or synodically, where the called pastor is a position leader, or the called pastor is not expected to exert leadership, but comes in as a preacher, or as a teacher, or as one who provides the sacramental ministries of the church, but is not really the one who is perceived as the mover and the shaker, who gets things done in the parish? Is that a model that you're hearing about, or facilitating that kind of leadership models in the church? I'm wondering if that may be something that needs to be addressed. Because the perception is that if you go 4 years to seminary with an internship, you are therefore a leader,
right,
and capable of managing a congregation.
Right.
And it's right. Seldom the case.
I would think in some congregations that's very helpful.
Yeah.
But in other congregations, the situations call for something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think you have to custom design the model based on the question at hand. But sometimes I think it can be helpful or hurtful depending on the situation and the people. I work with a lot of elected officials. They get a lot of messages so that they sort of are the experts and the voice. And sometimes situations they aren't very helpful because it doesn't share the responsibility with the people. We're doing a lot of work right now on working with trying to revitalize citizenship and the citizenry, because there's a lot of evidence in development work that human capital is absolutely essential. And so that doesn't mean just sort of the positional people, that means all of us and shared responsibilities. That the issues of the day are so complex that sort of the hero or the experts, I'm working on a project where we're looking at water quality, and we're finding that PhDs from the University of Minnesota and other places are terrific, and they're very good at what they do, but they're feeling very frustrated because our water supplies are getting worse than ever, and we have more PhDs in environmental science than ever before, and they're really good at what they do. So in that situation, the expert model isn't working right. And so we're actually figuring out a way to redesign the education of PhD candidates in environmental sciences so they have more expertise as facilitators and catalysts rather than sort of experts. So it may be that some pastors need a stronger background in health in being facilitators of sort of that collective notion. So I just want, we've got to close. Let me just kind of share with you some of the themes that came up. Maybe we can talk more. I'd love to talk more about with some of you about your questions. I think the need to change the vision question, the challenge of vision, and not just writing a mission statement, but a clarity of focus, mm-hmm. and how do we build that in ourselves and about the organizations that we're in. And just sort of the leadership of the church, what's the church trying to build? Are we clear on that? But a challenging thing. How do we empower people? A lot of ways on has to do with building relationships and the rigor around building relationships. The way we design our organizations in terms of being more inclusive with other people, even how we organize our work in meetings. And each of those are sort of detailed in and of themselves. And then clearly the resource questions. It's interesting that we didn't bring up money other than sort of money and everybody has its price, but even the resources, the gifts, how do we identify people's gifts and better use them? The notion of seeing our stories as our gifts and a tremendous resource if we know more ways to use those stories. So a lot of themes came up in sort of the challenges, and I think it just affirms that there are no easy answers about these things, very complex. So thank you for coming.